Hi there, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I recently had the great pleasure of talking with the very thoughtful and eloquent Avner Ben Zaken about two of his recent books, one, Cross-Cultural Scientific Exchanges in the Eastern Mediterranean, 1560 to 1660, that came out with Hopkins University Press in 2010, and the other is Reading Hay Ibn Yaqzan, A Cross-Cultural History of Autodidacticism, and that came out with Hopkins University Press in 2011. Now, we talked about both of these books together because they both represent a single, coherent, intellectual and scholarly project that Avner is embarking on at the moment. He's really interested in, and both books explore different aspects of the way that science and other forms of knowledge are created through and in cross-cultural exchanges. One of them, the Cross-Cultural Scientific Exchanges book, is a study of the ways that early modern science travels among localities and cultures, and it focuses on the context of an example of cosmologies, and this specifically post-Copernican cosmologies. It's an account of science being constituted through travel and through the kinds of communication and the kinds of practices that travel enables. The other book, the autodidacticism book, traces the composition, travels, and translations of a particular book, of Ibn Tufayl's Hay Ibn Yaqzan, as a way to get at a history of debates about autodidacticism in 12th century Marrakesh, 14th century Barcelona, Renaissance Florence, and 17th century England. And so these are two books. Both of them deal with very similar kinds of larger problems and questions and issues, but they do it in very different ways. We had a really interesting conversation, and this was a particularly enjoyable interview for me because we really had a chance to talk about larger intellectual, scholarly issues that have to do with writing, about what it can and should look like to do history, to train students in historical practice, and many other kinds of issues. I got a lot out of it, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, Avner.
Hey, Carla.
We're here today at New Books in Science, Technology, and Society to talk with Avner Ben Zaken about two of his recent books. One is Cross-Cultural Scientific Exchanges in the Eastern Mediterranean, 1560 to 1660, that came out with Johns Hopkins University Press in 2010, and the other is Reading Hay Ibn Yaqzan. Am I pronouncing that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, so Reading Hay Ibn Yaqzan, A Cross-Cultural History of Autodidacticism, and that also came out with Hopkins University Press, this time in 2011. Now, we're talking about these together because they form part of a very ambitious, a very fascinating, I think, not just for historians of science, but for people interested in the craft of historiography and the craft of really what it is to know about any kind of context, historically or not, given very challenging research conditions, particular challenges that come up in terms of the kind of training as well that we receive as scholars. They're both really interesting. They're both really, really innovative, and they have big ambitions. So they don't just present case studies for our edification, but Avner's really trying in these pieces to revise the way we think about history of science, the way we think about history, what it can look like to do history, and you know, to do also the studies of modernity in general. So they're fantastic books, Avner. Congratulations. And thank you so much for making the time to talk with us.
Thank you for the nice words.
No, really. I mean, this is really a pleasure to read both of these. And for listeners who may not have had a chance to read both of them, or perhaps this is the first you're hearing of them, I really do recommend thinking of them as two parts of a set. And so reading one, you'll definitely want to read the other. And I think they make sense together, and they make sense as really creating a conversation that enhances both of them individually, even though they stand on their own. So thank you.
Thank you.
So, Avner, could you start us off by just saying a little bit about And what brought you into this general field of early modern studies or early modern history? And I could ask you also about the history of science, but these are books that I think, even though they are history of science, are really doing work that expands or extends much more broadly into fields that anyone interested in early modern history will be interested in. So what brought you to early modernity in particular?
Well, I think and that's a very general argument that I make about the characters of my books, that the people are writing about themselves to a great extent. And looking into cross-cultural exchanges in general, and definitely in science, and I'll get, you know, to the point of science afterwards, but looking into cross-cultural exchanges was, for me, in a way, to tell a historical story about myself. My parents immigrated to Israel from Morocco, so I grew up in a multilingual house, and I was in one leg here and the other there, and I could see both sides. So I think it's a great perspective of not only criticizing either culture, but also, and that's what, you know, I'm interested in bringing up some constructive remarks about how these cultures actually collaborate and have things in common. So I get to science particularly for political reasons, because early on in college I was very much affiliated with the communism and Marxist thought and activity, and I even wrote my MA thesis on the relationship between a Jewish and Arab communist in the communist movement in the Middle East, which was published in 2006 as a book, but it's a completely different project. But I started off from this perspective to see first how people collaborate, but then the other Marxist argument that tried to give some kind of a description of I think a much fairer description of the rise of the West than other accounts, Weberians and others. So when we speak about the rise of the West and the decline, of course, it's just a metaphor of the East, I read in so many accounts mentioning or references to the scientific revolution as the turning point, as the watershed from which Europe came to be dominant of the world and the rest of the world fell into decline. So I said, for political reasons at the beginning, of course, but then I dropped the politics very early on to move to some intellectual curiosities, but I thought that it's a pretty sensitive nerve of world history in general. So I thought that the best way would be to start with searching and locating certain mentionings or documents or books or people who are referring to the expansion or dissemination of the Copernican Revolution very early on after Copernicus published his book in 1543 toward the Eastern Mediterranean. And I was very surprised to find, you know, diverse kinds of documents, either miniatures or manuscripts or books or other manuscripts that were actually translations from printed books. But then I discovered that there was a kind of a remarkable wave of encounters that went back and forth. And none of them was unilateral. It wasn't one-sided. Like the Europeans, when they came to the East, they weren't really transmitting any knowledge. But actually, that's what I'm saying, that they weren't sure about the Copernican cosmology. Not at all. And they were coming to the East to look for additional evidence that would prove that either or, of course, Copernicus is wrong or Tycho is right or vice versa. So I thought that this is a pretty interesting nerve, and if I'll be able to explore that nerve, then it could be a laboratory for much greater story, and that's how I came to the ambition that you mentioned, that the books are pretty ambitious, because I'm trying to extrapolate from a single point in history, a sensitive nerve, to a greater story concerning world history.
Mm-hmm. And One of the things that's so unusual about this process for someone reading the books and sort of looking at the trajectory that you've set out for yourself is that you're very prolific, right? I mean, a book coming out in 2010, 2011, and both of these, I'll phrase it as a question. What relation did these books, one and or the other, have to the dissertation project? I kind of hesitate to ask you about that transformation here because you very clearly have had a much more of a coherent historiographical agenda through which this set of case studies sort of lets you explore than many people, you know, entering grad school certainly have. And so what was the process for you moving from the stage of the dissertation into one or both of these works? And were there any major transformations at that occasion? Were there any major rethinkings? Can you talk about that process a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, actually the first book, Cross-Cultural Scientific Exchanges, is based on the dissertation. Mm-hmm. It is more or less the same as in the dissertation, with certain places, especially the theoretical stuff, mm-hmm. in which I try to make it much more appealing and not just giving an account of a few cases. In some of the cases, I even substantiate it with additional either documents or arguments that I received along the process of presenting the papers or presenting the chapters and having colleagues who read it and gave their own valuable, of course, input. So the first book is actually based on the dissertation. The second book has nothing to do with that, mm-hmm. not at all. So it was a completely new project that I actually handled when I was the Society of Fellows. Mm-hmm. And the first book was completed pretty early, a year after I finished my PhD, my grad school, and I moved in the next project pretty early and started working on it. And the connection, the interesting thing is that is the last chapter of the fourth chapter of the first book mentions an astronomer by the name John Gribbs, mm-hmm. From Oxford. And when I was investigating his travels, I discovered that to a certain time period, he traveled with another English scholar, Edward Pocock. And I remember sitting at the Clark Library, and I just, I called all the books of Pocock, and I got first editions there, yes? And I got his translation, Philosophus Autodidacticus, of a piece that I was pretty familiar with from the 12th century of Haibn Yaxzan. So I said, this is pretty interesting because it translates what I thought as an empirical philosophical text from medieval time in a time period when I knew that all the experimental, all the debate over experimentalism took place in Oxford, the place of publication. And I said, once I finish this dissertation, this is my next project. So that's what I did. And there is one particular difference between the two books, which I mention in the introduction of Reading Haibn Yaxzan, in which I say that the first book it's on one century and in one more or less particular area, whereas the second book goes along something like five centuries. Like we start with the 12th century, and it ends with the 17th century, and it moves from Marrakesh to Barcelona to Florence to Oxford. And that was much challenging, I would say, methodological challenge in general, because it was very hard for me to first to move from one chapter to the other, from one investigation to the other. It took me something like, cognitively speaking, something like 2 months to move or to understand what I'm getting into. Mm-hmm. So and afterwards I had to put them in some kind of a sequence that would make sense. After all, we are looking into the same manuscript, Haibn Yaxzan, and I'm looking for its circulation across Europe in the early modern time, late medieval, early modern time, and I'm giving a very deep contextual local description of its reception, reading, and so on. And yet we have very fragmented account. So then I suggested in the introduction to use a kind of a perception for modern art, visual art. It's called the art of sampling, in which artists put in sequence various representations of the same object. So I thought that maybe we can do the same with that case and call it historical sampling. So in this sense, it's pretty different than the early book.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you're bringing up the power of or the idea of historical sampling. Let's see, I'm kind of hearing myself a little bit here, so I'm going to turn off. Ah, and that's better. It's interesting that you're bringing up the idea of historical sampling, because one of the that was one of the fascinating historiographical things about that book for me, and we'll get there in the course of our conversation, but the first thing that came to my mind was electronic music and sampling in that sense, right? So when read that...
Well, that's how it started. Yes. That's how it started with DJs in the 80s, and then... Now we have a video artist, and in visual art we have historical sampling, definitely.
That's right. I mean, I think in a lot of ways the craft of the historian is the art of the DJ, right? And the sort of telling the larger narrative with quotation and citation and repetition of themes. And so it's really fun, actually, to read about that in the context of the reading Hayev Nyakson book. But, okay, so both of these books... represent parts of a coherent intellectual project in progress. And that's why we're talking about them together as sort of a bit of a break from the New Books Network interviews typically. And it's actually quite an exciting break and quite a pleasant break. And it's rare to have this opportunity. But they're both parts of a broader intellectual project. So I'd like for a moment or for several moments to talk a little bit about the contours of that project and the sort of the major components of that project that really come up in the context of both books, because I know it's something that seems important to you as a writer and came across as very important as a reader. Okay, so both books are rooted in showing how, or really one of the books in particular, the first book, showing how, as you mentioned before, briefly, this isn't just about science from one place or knowledge or an object, let's say in the second book, from one place being transmitted to another place. This is really about the construction of knowledge and the creation of knowledge, be it scientific knowledge, be it knowledge about autodidacticism and the ideas of the self, being created through travel, through circulation, and through the kind of translation and dialogue that circulation exchange enables, right? What made you so interested in this particular set of issues? Because can you talk a little bit about this broader set of issues? Because it's not necessarily the case that someone interested in, you know, science in early modernity would necessarily go here. It's a very particular and very clear historiographical project that both of these books are part of. So can you talk about that a little bit for our listeners?
Well, I think that the claims of the West to prominence were based on a few fundamental principles in relation, of course, to the scientific revolution. One of them was, of course, the Copernican cosmology. And I thought that maybe if I'll be able to elaborate and to perform the complex negotiations that were cross-cultural negotiations from both sides that were over the Copernican cosmology or revolution, then we'll have a way more nuanced account of what happened at that time period. And the second one was autodidacticism, because at the beginning I thought it's experimentalism, but it's not really experimentalism. Mm-hmm. It's experimentalism, it's one a derivative, I would say, of autodidacticism, which is the claim of a first-hand experience to be better than any accumulated, transmitted knowledge from the past. This is a pretty radical argument. And the West appropriated these fundamental arguments to its history, and of course used it as a tool in order to argue, to claim its prominence. But what I wanted to show in both books that in two fundamental concepts were actually negotiated in a cross-cultural exchange or exchanges, and I would add to it maybe for the future the question of print culture, which is something that I would really like in the future, a project I would really like to take in order to complete this trilogy. I think it's going to be a trilogy.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, that's exciting. I'll look forward to that, and I look forward to talking with you about the third one. The importance of print culture actually does come up in both books to some extent, but certainly in
the first one.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this idea of cross-cultural exchange, and we'll continue to talk about this because there are various aspects of this that remain unpackable and really important. But one of the things here that it seems to me you're trying to do is to, at least from a reader's perspective, to reframe how we think about, conceptualize, and do research on the notion of a local culture. Right? I mean, in order to have cross-cultural exchange, we need to be able to, however instrumentally, identify and say something about a local culture. So what does it mean? What does a local culture mean for you? Let's sort of start on that. What does that look like? What does that mean? How do you think about that?
That's a very good question, because I try to place myself in between the two historiographical trends of, on the one hand, the old history of ideas that try to account to the floating of ideas in the air with nobody touching them or having no cultural context, something really problematic. But I thought that the greatest virtue of such history was that it was way more prismatic than any histories, local histories that we had in the recent, let's say, 30 years. Now, the biggest problem for me was that widely historians explore the cultural context and the practices in a certain location in order to recover from them, to project from them ideas, to recover structures of ideas, structures of society. And of course, at the end, they produced incredible accounts on how science was culturally constructed, especially in Europe. But for me, it was a big problem, because once you investigating, exploring deeply into one culture, at the same time, you are actually detaching this location, this culture, from other adjacent cultures. And the result was that we ended up with what I called monadic cultures that exist in and of themselves, and earliest, I said, even cultures that supposedly had nothing to do with each other. And somebody, and I hope that in the future historians will look into this problem, and they will try to put them together to look for connections between them. So for me, cultural, local culture cannot really produce its own values, cannot really produce its own ideas, cannot really produce anything really stimulating that would revolutionize that culture. It has to be enriched from the outside, fertilized from the outside. And that's why I say that I'm not really interested in cultural centers. I believe that cultural centers that only circulate ready or accumulated knowledge, whereas the margins of cultures, where one margin of one culture overlaps with the margin of other culture, creates some kind of what I call the mutually embraced zone in which people exchange freely with no hegemonic or relations of power. And eventually those ideas are traveling from the margins to the centers and stimulate new ideas about science, about culture, about politics.
Mm-hmm. So how do you, just to ask you to expand a little bit about something that you just said, one of the I mean, you do talk about these zones of mutual exchange here, and it's very much, it will remind readers who are familiar with, for example, Galison's notions of trading zones and other work on circulation of knowledge. And this is a very, very important, very path-breaking part of our historiography right now. But how do you think about power relations in these zones? Because as if we look at other kinds of frontier history, right, American history, history of the American West, one of the critiques of the kind of historiography that posited zones of exchange, not in the context of the history of science, but in other kinds of histories of the frontier, one of the critiques has been in the past that presenting the story as one of mutual exchange and benefit seems to be somewhat, so it just doesn't perhaps take seriously the very real issues of unequal power dynamics and moments of rupture, moments of tension within these kinds of exchanges. So can you speak a little bit to how you see those issues in the context of these cases that you're working on here?
Yes, definitely. I think that the greatest problem with dealing with cross-cultural exchanges in the early modern times, it's not, we're not only speaking about different cultures, we are talking about cultures that were identified with certain paradigms. So we have incommensurability of paradigms and cultures at that time period. So when we see, when we locate some kind of transmission, circulation, or exchange of ideas, it's not only an exchange between cultures, but between also different, completely different set of concepts regarding science. Now, the early modern time, I think, is not, at least until the 17th century, it's not the time where we had a very clear relations of power between East and West. I think that those relations of powers, those notions, or at least consciousness of hegemony, was still negotiated at that time period. I would definitely say that you're right in cases of a frontier history after the Industrial Revolution, definitely you're right. We have plenty of cases in which the hegemonic culture or power came and dictated its own values and scientific thought and transformed politics and society. But in the 16th century, that's what I wanted to say. The 16th century, and that's why it's 16th, 17th century, that's why it's so fascinating, it was all still under negotiation. And if it was still under negotiation, we might, by exploring that time period, also find the reasons in which we have a complete cultural or a consciousness shift of hegemony between East and West. But it's I cannot really say that until 1650 or something like that, that in either side, either Europeans or Middle Easterns, would have said clearly that they know that their culture are rising or in decline.
So when you say in the book that you mean these projects to be to inform how we think about modernity as well, not just history of science, but you do mention in here that you're also trying to contribute to the way we understand the history of modernity. Is this part of what you mean by that? Is this
definitely, definitely? I think that in the second book, in Reading Haib and Yaxzan, it's much more clear because I start with a very modern question. What would you do in an isolated desert island?
Right.
And this is a very modern, I would say, question in contemporary culture, because it tells us, let's strip ourselves from all the values, all the false needs, all the hegemonic consciousness that somehow was along, you know, a social process was inserted into our minds. And let's be the self, the true self, look for the true self inside of us. So I said this is a really modern question. Mm-hmm. So, but this really modern question was born in a certain time period. And it was not born only because of, you know, different processes within Europe, but also because we have so many incidents in which people actually defied authority, defied establishment. And they used different tools, different arguments, different books. And what I suggest that they refer to this book, to read in Chaya Ben Yaxzan, in order to make their claims against the establishment way much more effective. So to a great extent, we have in the early modern time a shift between the icons of wisdom, whereas in the medieval time it was the old man who accumulated knowledge, and at the end of his life he can transfer this knowledge to younger generations. The modern icon of wisdom and of science becomes a little boy. And the little boy has very fresh imprints in his mind. He uses first-hand experience. He's not, you know, referring to any prejudice or tradition or anything that comes from the past, and he can really give birth to new ideas. This is modernity. But what I'm saying is that this principle of modernity, we can find it in a fabulous, brilliant philosophical tale from the 12th century Marrakesh. And it's not only that we can find it there, we can trace the way this book circulated into Europe to all the very important stations, historical stations, in which these notions, these liberal notions of modernity were actually constructed. And of course, I go to Barcelona to speak about education, and then from there we move to Florence, and of course, Pico della Mirandola for me was the first intellectual to make a bold arguments referring to liberal notions of letting people shape their own destiny, that experience in life is what really shapes our not only beliefs, even our the most perverted would say habits. So experience, that's the question. And later on, of course, we have in Oxford the question of experience and of first-hand experience completely incorporated into scientific thought and philosophy of science with Robert Boyle, and the final, of course, station, the person who wraps everything up, John Locke.
Great. Thank you, Avner. Now, I want to ask you about, because you brought up the issue of defying authority, right? And then this issue as it speaks to the translations and transitions that we see in the reading Chaya Ibn Yaxzan book, which brings us into a way that perhaps you might be trying to defy authority here in your comments. And I say that as a good thing. I really mean that as a good thing. I think this is one of the contributions you're trying to make. And this is the issue that you bring up in the introductory matter, really, of both books. And this is the issue of a concern with the way that academic training leads historians to learn about and study yes. local cultures. And so what I'd really love to hear a little bit about, or lots about, is if you could talk about that set of issues, and also if we could talk about how your concern with these shapes your own research methodology, which is very, the research involved in doing these books is astounding for a reader. So can you talk about these two issues, both the issue of training and then how this shapes your own research methodology?
Well, definitely. I think that you made a very a brilliant comment about my psychological structure. You're definitely right that I'm trying to project my own defiance of authority and my own various problems with establishments to the, of course, historical theme that I try to explore. So the scientific claim of history is, I'm not getting, of course, to the question, you know, how can we bring our account as closer to the truth as possible. That's completely another issue. But there's one issue which is, I think, a very important, which is the structure of a discipline. That what I think eventually shapes and give direction to the different efforts to explore historical truth. So the structure, of course, it's a very traditional structure. I would even say it's a clear reflection of the rise of the nation state. So we have Chinese science, as you know, we have Islamic science, we have German science, we have French science, we have Italian science, we have this kind of balkanization of scientific thought. But is it true? Like, can we really speak about science in these kind of terms? Maybe because we have these fields, eventually we train scholars to focus only on sources from these, from their fields, from their subfields, and eventually creating a structure of a historical production that eventually perpetuate the same problems from the past. What we really need here is just to cross the disciplines. So when I claim to write a cross-cultural history in both books, there was another implied claim in that, which is to cross disciplines. I'm not intended, and you see it in my, I'm not even calling it a research, investigations. I'm not willing to let any boundary, disciplinary boundary or culture, to stop me from continue on exploring questions that I think intuitively, I think are pertinent to my investigation. So in many cases, by the way, I came or reached fields or subfields that I had nothing to do with. I knew nothing about it. So in the process of this investigation, I had to understand and to read the whole historiography of this subfield and to understand what are the claims and to understand what's going on there. So you see in these books that I'm moving and I'm crossing actually not cultures, but actually disciplines. Mm-hmm. And this is what really fascinates me. And eventually, you know, the shortcoming of that is that you're entering, each time you're entering into a field where people are experts of. So they feel a bit uncomfortable that you're coming from a different field and you have not only new claims but even bold claims about their field. So it depends. In certain places I had very fruitful exchanges with those scholars. In other places they were pretty reluctant to accept this kind of ideas. But of course they're guarding, they're the gatekeepers of their disciplines and they won't let anyone to break this fence. But what I wanted to do in this research, speaking particularly about the methodology, it's to break disciplinary fences. And maybe in the future, in history departments all over the world, people would start seriously thinking about interdisciplinarity in the sense of training students to move from one side to the other. I trained myself like that, of course, and I had a fabulous a dissertation committee that each one of them actually covered an angle in my research culturally and thematically speaking. But I think it should be much more structured. Students should feel much more encouraged to cross this kind of boundaries. Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine in your ideal world here? And so I know one of the themes of the book, certainly the reading Hayy Ibn Yaqdhan book, is utopia, right? And so as we're talking about ideal worlds, what just to hear a little bit about this, in your ideal world, what does that kind of training, let's say for a graduate student, look like?
Well, it has to be, speaking about autodidacticism, it has to come from the student himself. Mm-hmm. I find it very hard, of course, to think about the idea that there would be a structure that would be superimposed on a student to be interdisciplinary. So it has to come from the student himself. He has to be way more curious than just in his own particular field. He shouldn't be, and that's a key issue, he shouldn't be afraid from the uncertainty of getting into new fields, new bodies of knowledge. It's fun, just fun to acquire and to take over one body of knowledge after the other. I never speak about what I know. It's, for me, it's useless. I always, you know, I find it as a great opportunity to write another paper, a new paper. It's very stressing, I have to say, especially in the last year, but it's a great pleasure to learn something new. And I think that this is the key issue in being a historian. It's not that you produce history. It's not that you're only teaching history. You have a great opportunity to study. For me, it's a never-ending process of learning and studying, maybe to the rest of your life.
Right. Great. And I think mentioning one of the words you just mentioned or you just used, fear, I think is key here. I think sort of taking some of the culture of fear out of historical training might go a long way toward manifesting the kinds of conditions that you're talking about. Okay, yeah. So we've talked about training, but one of the things that speaks directly to what you're doing here really takes these issues and pushes them into your own practice. Now, both books range across a phenomenal number of languages, of kinds of literature, of disciplinary contexts. Can you say a little bit about either for the process of either book, whichever you want to talk about, or if you feel that it's a more general conversation, we can do that as well, your own research process for this? I mean, there are a tremendous number of manuscripts involved, lots of different archives. What was it like to research these books?
It was a torture. No, I'm just kidding. I'd say that in the process of investigating, I have to be completely possessed by the theme, by the personas that I'm looking at. So it's a very, very intensive time period. It takes, 4 or 5 months until I finish one case. So being possessed, it's not, I'm not saying it just to describe a mental situation. I think it's the best way of doing this kind of research, because eventually you develop a kind of intuitive perception of that time period. And you try to pull the strings. And the strings would be, of course, either text, either, comment of somebody, and to look into it and to see what's the connection between that comment or that title or this word with other words. And it leads you to new directions, to explore new horizons. But it's mostly an intuitive effort. And what's important for me more than anything else is to ask the right questions. And they have to be very particular questions. Very, very particular questions. That's, you start off your project, your investigation, from a very particular question regarding a date or a person. And from that, the particular question has to do, of course, with abnormality, because I'm doing microhistory. And we're looking for the abnormal things, either, processes, persons, events, titles, and this kind of things. And by exploring these, a particular question of an abnormal case, we actually are able to reconstruct a fascinating, very marginal incident. And the biggest problem, of course, is that how we extrapolate from that into a greater story or a big account. My way of doing that was twofold. First, always speak about the limits of your sources and try to describe and to understand the limits of your sources. And then when you extrapolate, you have to counterpose what you see with other things around you and to look for some kind of a structural connection or an analogous connection between your story and other structures. It could be, of course, political structures, as we saw with the story of Pico della Mirandola, and it could be, of course, social, it could be educational, it could be either or, but you should look in your surroundings. Now, to a great extent, what I do, it's a kind of a morphology, okay? It's very hard to, I do not believe, differently than some other microhistorians, that you can really draw a causality in morphology. The best we can do is to put forms or incidents or structures next to each other and let you, the reader, decide whether there is a connection here. It's very hard, it's almost impossible to actually reconstruct an agency that caused this and that. But if you put a kind of an array of structures, text, ideas, people, that we're not only have similar relations, it's not comparative history, but we're actually in personal contact. We're next to each other. We're doing the same things. We're in relationship. Then we're able to make a much, I think, richer account of those incidents.
Now, listeners, hearing your account of your own process and your own historiographical commitments, and especially the comments on microhistory and that kind of methodology, many listeners, I'm sure, will immediately be thinking of Carlo Ginzburg's work, and to some extent, Natalie Zeman Davis. I mean, kind of scents of what you're saying that are very much part of those two authors' works as well. As somebody who's very self-conscious and very reflective and self-reflexive about your own contribution to historiographical practice and methodology, was there a particular work or a particular author or authors who you found especially inspiring in shaping your own methodology?
Well, I was very lucky, I am very lucky to be in touch and in exchange with Carlo Ginzburg and Natalie Zeman Davis. But I was a student of Carlo in one of his seminars, and I think that the all methodology or the way, or my version to microhistory started off definitely in his seminar that was really inspiring, stressing, moving. And to these days, I definitely owe Carlo a great debt in helping me develop this kind of approach to historiography. So, of course, there's, you know, the Cheese and the Worms, which is a great book, a famous one. Everybody read it. But and The Return of Martin Guerre with Natalie. But I don't think that there is a particular text that inspired me. It's not a particular text. I think it's more a methodology. It's more an argument. It's more of a seeing people the way they think, and trying to understand the way they think, and to see how this kind of way of thinking can eventually benefit your own work. I cannot speak about text, but I can definitely speak about structures of thinking that I was exposed to, luckily, very luckily, I would say, and that helped me shape my methodology.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, we don't have much time to talk about the particulars of both books, and there's a ton of material in both books that's fascinating that we won't get to, but I want to just very briefly move, even if it's just a step, into each one of them in the remaining time that we have. Now, cross-cultural scientific exchanges in the Eastern Mediterranean, 1560 to 1660, as we've already mentioned, this is a study of the ways that early modern science, sort of broadly conceived, traveled among localities and cultures. And you focus on the example of Copernicanism and post-Copernican cosmologies and the ways that these actually get created through this travel. Now, it's an account, as we've mentioned, of the science really being constituted by those travels. Now, you've talked a little bit about your move from a story about incommensurability to one of mutually embraced zones. We've talked about sort of the importance of circulation here. One of the things that I'd love to hear about, though, speaks to your comments on the importance of the margins, right? The importance of the abnormal. And this is very much, it seems from a reader's perspective, of a piece with another claim that you make in this particular book, which is that scientific ideas are not propagated by intellectual networks and agents and agendas, but rather by mundane ones. And so this claim of the importance of the mundane networks, this importance of mundane networks of contact, really seems to be of a piece with this emphasis on the margins and perhaps the abnormal that you're also projecting. Can you talk about that and perhaps in the context of talking about that, maybe specifically using as an example from this book and sort of as a way of showing how those mundane networks of contact are important?
Okay, well, I haven't seen it even once an intention to transmit certain idea. You have an intention in a place where you have relations of power, somebody who knows that he has a very good idea that is worthwhile, you know, to transfer it to somebody that might benefit from that idea. But what I saw, it's just random encounters with objects, not with ideas. I don't believe in ideas. They exist up there. I never touched an idea. But I saw text, and I saw manuscripts, and I saw paintings. And people ran across these material objects. And the way they encountered that object, those objects, was pretty random. And I say to myself, well, nobody had an intellectual agenda to propagate this notion, but actually these objects were circulated within social, economic networks, cross-cultural networks, as you know, gifts or looted on boats, or just, you know, circulated by travelers who exchanged objects that exchange with no intention at all, hands from one person from one culture to the other one. So what fascinated me is that, if that's right, I said that nobody had an intention to propagate the Copernican Revolution. Nobody wanted really to say, listen, we have a revolution in cosmology, and you better listen to this revolution, and let us give you the gist of that cosmology. That's not what happened. And the indication from this conclusion is that we do not really see any relations of power at that time period. It definitely happens, as I conclude, of course, at the end, and I start in the introduction with that story. From the 1660 onward, we see a clear shift in this perception. People know that there is a revolution. People know that there are better ideas. People know that Europe was completely shocked by new cosmology, and you better update your own perception of the world, of the universe, but not until 1660 or so.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, in the process of the story that you're telling us, which begins with an absolutely beautiful story of Taqi ad-Din Muhammad ibn Ma'ruf, right?
Am I getting
that? And an observatory that he built for Ottoman Sultan Murad III. You take us into a really beautiful illustration from the Shahnama,
yes.
Right, to set out what may have been the work done at the Ottoman observatory. And I say this not to sort of ask you to elaborate on this, but rather to point out for listeners that the your discussion of the importance of particular images and objects and books, this isn't just a sort of general claim that you're making. This very much shapes the fabric and the structure of the story that you're telling and of the research methodology that you're using. So this really does the importance of book collecting in this story, the importance of sort of travels and the study of languages and dictionaries to this story is very much part of the larger story of the travels of post-Copernicanism across many different cultures. And it's very fascinating. Now, one of the things that comes up in this book that's perhaps going to be surprising for many readers, certainly was surprising to me, and that segues us into a brief discussion of the second book, and you can sort of tell how much I'm skipping over here, is the importance of Sufism to early modern science and knowledge in a global context. Now, this was extraordinarily interesting in the first book, and it's also something that comes up again right from the beginning of the second book. Can you speak a little bit to that, and in the context of either or both books? So whatever examples from either or both books you want to use to discuss that.
Okay, maybe it will give me the opportunity to speak about one of my next projects too.
Great.
So, yeah, so what I found in the first book, the fifth chapter, that the guy who translated this astronomical work of Noël Duret was, and I discovered that only by reading his introduction and understanding the usage of metaphors in his title, the title he chose for his translation, that he was actually a Sufi or somehow affiliated with Sufism. And I thought it's worthwhile to elaborate on the philosophical argument that are pertinent to the question of the scientific revolution from the vantage point of this kind of mystical thought. So, of course, what comes to mind first, and I hope that I performed it, demonstrated it in the text itself, that people are not trying to save the phenomena in mysticism. As you know, the traditional Aristotelian natural philosophy, they are not trying to describe what they see. What they're looking for, it's what is actually behind the scene, to unveil nature. But they're not only trying to unveil nature, of course, this project of unveiling the truth, unveiling society, unveiling the self, unveiling God. You know, it has various dimensions, but the notion or the structure of this notion that there is a practice by which one can unveil or overcome, if you want, his senses, can unveil this screen of that separates us from the forces of nature, from the true motion of the planets in the case of this fifth book. So this structure become very subversive in at that time period, especially among philosophers and scientists who were completely Aristotelians. Now, as for the second book, we have the same story with the first chapter, where I'm trying to understand why would anybody, definitely a philosopher in the 12th century, write such a radical tale, make such a radical argument that a little boy that was spontaneously generated on an island without language, without genetics, genetic code, without parents, without books, only through trial and error, was able to establish the principles of physics, and only through observations he could understand the structure of the universe and then make a metaphysical deductions and become the greatest philosopher of all. So that was, for me, there's no way it's only a philosophical tale. It's not history of ideas. He's actually corresponding with something around him. And what I suggested, as in the title of that chapter, that he tried actually to tame the mystics and to tell the Sufis, okay, guys, you're right, first-hand experience is very much important, but you have to do it according to the philosophical procedure. You have to go through the procedure to the hierarchy of disciplines in order, indeed, you're right, in order to discover yourself what is the truth, and not to receive it, you know, from a third side. But in both cases, I think that this is my own contribution to a much larger project that started maybe with Francis Yates, with the question of Hermeticism, in which she tried to show that, she showed actually that irrational mystical ideas such as from Hermeticism, not only hindered the progress of science, but actually was the engine behind the scientific revolution, because finally people started asking questions about what is beyond the natural phenomena, what is the mechanism that makes a natural phenomena. And that's what brings me, you know, to the third, to the next project that I'm working on now. One of my projects, I just presented a paper on that project Florence in the EUI on May, and I looked into another manuscript, another piece from the medieval Andalusia. It's called the Picatrix. It's a famous handbook for recipes for magic, and I just wanted to see who read it in the Renaissance. How did they read it? What exactly they appropriated from it? What did they do with that? And instead of looking on this book as only a book of recipes, I tried to show that the foundations or the contours of the philosophy of science of those central figures like Marcello Ficino and Cornelius Agrippa and Tommaso Campanella, that the three of them, to my view, the three of them played central role in transforming science, or I would say in making the magical scientific revolution. And the contours that the Picatrix gave to these thinkers was to start thinking about the acting at a distance, the agency that goes in between bodies and create motion in a much more physical way. Whereas, you know, mystics thought about this agency as a spiritual agency, they started talking about it as a spiritual and physical agency, what we call today, of course, forces, radiance, energy, and so on. But what they did, and that was fascinating, they tried to embody that in making arguments about the sun rays and saying, like, these spiritual physical entities, these forces, let's say electromagnetic forces, just, you know, to make it clear to our listeners, behave or act, propagate the same way as the sun rays. And that was a great contribution. So what I try to do is to show that Yet's argument were clearly brilliant, and she transformed completely the field. But what is left from her account is that we know that only the corpus hermeticum, only the hermeticism, played the role in transforming science into a science that looks to unveil phenomena and to look for forces. I want to say that it's not only that. We have also other works, important works, key works, that those people actually read, and they didn't come from neither ancient Greek, Egyptian tradition, but actually from an Arabic, Andalusian culture.
Thank you. And this is, there are lots of other questions that I can give you about this second book, but this is actually a perfect place for us to, I think, wrap up. And so rather than doing that, I think this is a good opportunity for us to bring this together. I want to, there's a ton of material that we didn't have a chance to talk about. And I want to just do two things now. First, mention something to our listeners and also ask you if there's anything you want to mention. And so first, just for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book, though we've been talking a lot about the very important and interesting larger historiographical issues that inform a lot of the cases we've been talking about as ways to using to talk about these issues, the books themselves are full of very, very detailed, very careful readings of many texts in Hebrew, in Arabic, in Persian, in Latin, in European languages, in English, that really enrich our bibliography, our sort of intellectual bibliography of texts that we think about when we think about what's relevant to understanding the global history of science. And so not only are there account or discussions of these very important general issues, but there are also discussions that I found completely fascinating about studies of classical Hebrew texts and how they were part of really both stories in different ways that open up. And this is just one example among many of really detailed readings in here, I think, that open up tons of future directions for the history of science in very specific ways that either, Avner, you may want to follow up on in future books, but even if not, I think these open up lots of opportunities for future scholars as well who want to pick up on any of these individual, like I said, very fascinating and very, very specific and well-grounded and grounded in very, very detailed research cases that you are offering to us, I think, is a gift here. So thank you for that. And I want to make sure that that's clear for our listeners, even though we didn't have a chance to talk about some of these really fascinating, very detailed cases in the course of our conversation. Now, speaking of things that we didn't have a chance to talk about, Avner, is there anything in particular, and there's tons that we didn't get to, but is there anything about either one of these books, about both books, that you want to make sure to mention for listeners that we may not have had a chance to get to in the course of our conversation?
Well, I'll tell a story. As I said, I was in Florence on May, mm-hmm. and the third chapter on reading Hai Bin Yaxdan was about Pico della Mirandola. Mm-hmm. And in that chapter, I was just pulling the strings, just following my intuition. And I think that I discovered, fascinating a story about homosexual relations, a political transformation in 1492 in Florence, and then a strong campaign against homosexuality. And all these, of course, accumulated to a writing of the Disputationes of Pico against astrology, in which, of course, he cites the book of Hai Bin Yaxdan. And I was, along the process, I could sense that eventually we have a story between lovers. And it was, of course, Pico, and Benivieni was his lover at the beginning, but then I think he switched, there was a change of hearts there. And he became a partner of Poliziano. But whereas Poliziano was completely open about his sexual tendencies, and Pico was much more careful. But what fascinated me along the process are two things. First, reading a letter of Poliziano in which he writes to Pico that he remembered the love songs that he wrote, in which he describes, you know, young boys as sexual objects, and Pico was really embarrassed. And the second thing, that I was very lucky that when I started researching on that theme, I read in the Corriere della Sera that the few scientists exhumed the bodies of Pico and Poliziano from San Marco, and they passed them, you know, a battery of scientific tests, and determined that they were both poisoned. And I said, oh my God, I'm the first one who is going to write positively that Pico didn't die in 29, like suddenly, it was just poisoned. And there are reasons for this murder, and there are suspects for this murder. So when I was in Florence on May, I went to look for the tomb of Pico, and I wanted to see exactly, like, I knew that he's buried next to Benivieni, but so there was a mess. It was Sunday. I didn't want to interrupt anybody. And I was standing outside, and a priest was walking. And I approached him, and I said, listen, I'm looking maybe for an inner court, which, you know, I can find the tomb of Pico della Mirandola. He said, well, it's in the cathedral in San Marco. Let me show you that. And then he says to me, 5 years ago, I exhumed the body of Pico.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, he was poisoned. And I said, of course I know he was poisoned. So what I would really be happy that if from now on, people would refer to the death of Pico as a murder. And it's a murder mystery. I try to give you my own intuition of who could be a part of it or what were the reasons for that. But I would be very happy if, you know, scholars in the future would look for this very mysterious murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. That's a very very good note to end on, I think, as we move forward. Avner, these are two wonderful books. Congratulations doubly. And thank you so much for making the time to talk with me about it today. I've had a lot of fun, and I really look forward to seeing what you come up with next.
Okay, thank you very much, Carla. Thank you for the great questions.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.